Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Betsy DeVos's website describes her as a disruptor. Now that she's confirmed as education secretary, what calls for disruption is the set of myths that carried her through, despite an evident lack of experience or expertise. Myths to do with school choice and accountability that corporate media rarely interrogate thoroughly or contrast with different visions of education. We'll talk about that with Kevin Kumashiro, former Dean of Education at the University of San Francisco and founder of Education Deans for Justice and Equity. Also on the program, the new lawsuit, Public Citizen versus Trump, stems from the administration's executive order requiring federal agencies to eliminate two regulations for every new one they institute. Press Secretary Sean Spicer says the suit presumes a lot of outcomes that are wildly inaccurate. Our guest says it presumes outcomes that not only are predictable, but that reflect the order's actual intention. Amit Narang is regulatory policy advocate at Public Citizens Congress Watch. All of that is coming up, and this week we're going to go straight to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. There were near countless causes for concern about the appointment of deep-pocketed Republican Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education. She's given money to 17 of the senators voting on her. She's never taught or had her children in public school. She seemed to know little about core educational issues, like the debate over measuring students' proficiency versus their growth, or whether or not the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act is a federal law. In the end, her line about needing guns in schools for grizzly bears might be the least worrisome thing about her. Yet here we are. It's been said that the education secretary has less day-to-day power than other agency heads. But what does the DeVos appointment represent in terms of this administration's potential impact on children and schools? And how do we fight for a different vision? Kevin Kumashiro is former dean of the School of Education at the University of San Francisco and founder of Education Deans for Justice and Equity. He's the author of the book Bad Teacher: How Blaming Teachers Distorts the Bigger Picture. He joins us now by phone from California. Welcome back to Counterspin, Kevin Kumashiro.
Janine, thanks so much for having me.
Well, I think it's fair to raise concern about DeVos's lack of classroom experience, but I can imagine someone who has never taught, who nevertheless understood what teachers do. As with other Trump appointments, it seems like it's not a matter of DeVos not being the best person. The problem is that she represents a position that's opposed to the mission of the department. Is that fair to say, do you think?
I think that's very fair to say. I mean, I think in so many instances, having outsider perspectives can be very helpful. So I agree, it's not about whether or not she herself has taught, although that would be very helpful if she has. It's more about what is her vision for public education and what is her track record that shows what she's already done and where she is likely to take public education. And, you know, the Department of Education was created in a time when the federal government was leveraging the little money that it has in public education, well, little in terms of the percentage, right? Mm-hmm. The federal government accounts for only about 10% of public school funding, but, you know, it's a $600 billion a year enterprise nationally. There's lots of money to be made in public education. So the federal government, for several decades, from the 50s through the 80s, was actually exerting more and more influence to try to make public schools address diversity, equity, and injustices. That was the kind of hallmark of this string of legislation that came through the federal government that culminated in 1979 in the creation of the Department of Education. So if we're now saying that the role of the federal government is not to advance issues of equity, diversity, and social justice, but rather to fuel the privatizing and the dismantling of public education, then that absolutely is a big shift from historically where it's been going, and a big shift from what should be its primary role in schooling.
Well, yes, having people in charge of agencies that they don't think should exist is a special kind of confusing, including for people who have to report on it. But what we get are sort of arguments about ideas and then a lot of buzzwords. And school choice, like accountability, is a great buzzword. And in taking off from what you've just been saying about the original intent of the whole department, school choice is being presented as, in particular, a way for students of color and poor kids to access the great equalizer that is education. You know, wealthy kids presumably already have school choice, you know? So I find the cynicism of Betsy DeVos professing to care about poor black and brown children almost unbearable. But first of all, no one says some charter schools haven't helped some kids, right? But we have data here. And if it's kids that we care about, those data just don't support a shift of resources away from public schools.
Oh, absolutely. When we talk about the track record of Betsy DeVos, we should look at Michigan, because it's in Michigan where she leveraged millions of dollars to rapidly expand the creation of charter schools at the same time that she pushed for legislation that would deregulate, in other words, that would lessen the oversight of charter schools. And particularly in Detroit, this is what we saw, right? A proliferation of charter schools with far less oversight. And are we seeing the kind of gaps in achievement and attainment being closed? Well, absolutely not. Even proponents of school choice are saying that the very expensive experiment in Detroit was a failure. And the test scores show it as well, right? Michigan schools have seen the what's called the nation's report card, the NAEP scores. The test scores actually go down in the short time that she has kind of been leading these reforms. It is not the case that school choice is serving the most disenfranchised. You know, I like to point out the irony that when we talk about a democracy, of course, freedom of choice is a very big part of that conceptually. But within the realm of education, we very narrowly defined what we mean by school choice. It is often a way to move funding around, and who benefits the most is actually not those who struggle the most. It tends to be those who already have access, who already have privilege, who know how to work the system. School choice is not proving to be a savior, and if that's the singular focus of this secretary, then we have a really big problem. We need to be looking at the bigger picture. We need a more complex understanding of the system, and that's not what we're seeing yet with this new secretary.
Well, people may be somewhat starved for silver linings right now, but I have seen a number of people saying that they're grateful that there was such a big fight around Betsy DeVos. One piece said, Americans don't generally get this worked up over education, which I'm not sure is really true. But it is true that power over schools is more decentralized in some ways than some other areas, and there are more points for potential involvement. But I wonder, going forward, do you see something that we can use from the argument that we've been having over her appointment?
Yeah. Let me make two points. One is kind of historically, and then one is moving forward. Historically, I think we need to remind ourselves that both Democrats and Republicans have brought us to where we are right now, right? In the last administration under President Obama and the secretaries Arne Duncan and John King, they were moving us towards things like narrowly defining standards and accountability, fueling the growth of school choice and of privatizing and marketizing school systems. So it's the kinds of things that we're talking about that Betsy DeVos has pushed in Michigan is actually building on the history that we've led ourselves to over the past 3.5 decades. So both sides are to blame for bringing us to this point. And I think when we hold our leaders accountable, let's hold everyone accountable for the failures of past so-called reforms and of coming up with much bolder visions for what schools should look like that are based in research. I think moving forward, one of the entry points for activism is that in this moment, as you've pointed out, we have move towards more decentralization. When the federal government reauthorized the very big education law called the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, it was first created in 1965. It was reauthorized just last December. When they reauthorized it, one of the really big, important changes they made was they weakened the federal government. And this was because both Democrats and Republicans were so unhappy with the move under particularly the Obama administration to hoist even more testing and even more decision-making based on those tests, which is what we call high-stakes testing. Even more high-stakes testing was happening to a point where our kids, everyone knew they were being over-tested, and there wasn't really much gains from that. So as a result, we rewrote the law and we weakened the ability of the federal government to push states. Why is this a problem? Because we first created that law in the midst of the civil rights movement, in the midst of the war on poverty, to force states and school districts to address issues of equity and diversity in their school systems. We've weakened the federal government, which strengthens the states and the locals. What we need to recognize then is that our organizing really needs to target the locals and the states. So it is an interesting time that she's coming in right when we have this new law. And I think activists need to be mindful of there is a role that the federal government plays, but there's also very significant roles that the state and local governments play in education. And we need to learn how the system works and target our activism towards that.
Well, to your point about there being a lot of pre-existing groundwork, if you will, for this moment, the Chicago Tribune endorsed Betsy DeVos because they said she reminded them of Arne Duncan. You know, so there are people who see the record and they're okay with it, you know. But bigger picture, I wonder if media's overall framing is less than helpful. There's a picture of key players, and that's teachers, which kind of really means unions, and there's parents, and then there's quote-unquote reformers, and it's supposedly a kind of power tug of war. Do you think that we're just asking, or that media are just asking the wrong questions? How should the conversation change around education?
I think sometimes the media likes to paint a story where there's two sides and they're battling. And it's just not so simple in this case. Both unions very quickly endorsed Obama when he was running for re-election, despite that was the middle of the Arne Duncan administration, as we already knew the direction that education was moving in. As you pointed out, a lot of attention was given to the statement about grizzly bears, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why we need guns. But there were so many deeper, much more complicated conversations that we needed to be having. Let me point to one. Right after her confirmation, a lot of media attention was played on how all the Democrats staged that 24-hour talkathon to stall the confirmation vote in the full Senate. We didn't talk about how a lot of those Democrats actually supported the policies that she's talking about around privatization. We didn't talk about how the two Republicans who dissented were actually in the Senate committee, and had either of them voted against her in committee, it would have never gone to the Senate vote. We also didn't talk about how within hours of the confirmation vote, one of our congresspeople put forward a one-sentence bill that basically would dissolve the Department of Education in the end of 2018. These are some of the muted stories that point to these bigger struggles over what public schools can and should be looking like. And let me just tie the dots with one more point. Mm-hmm. I think we've come to a point in our nation where the framing conversation around education is how we can fuel competition to make things better. It's like grocery stores in a neighborhood. It's the competition that's going to make things better. Well, in a competition, there has to be both winners and losers. That's what it means to structure a competition. And so we should be asking ourselves, why are we talking about education where we presuppose, where we expect that some are going to lose? Why do we talk about education as if it's a commodity where those who have the resources can get the best and the masses get something very substandard? public education was first envisioned by some of our earliest leaders in this country were thinking and talking about public education as a public good, as something that every child should be able to walk to and attend a school that embodies the very best that our nation has to offer. We've lost sight of this idea that education should be a central institution in our democratic nation. We are more and more buying into the story that it is a commodity or it is a competition, and some will get something great and the masses will not. That's the underlying story that needs to be really rattled. And these small debates over outlandish statements or even policy issues sometimes mask that really deeper debate that we as a nation need to be having.
We've been speaking with Kevin Kumashiro of Education Deans for Justice and Equity, online at educationdeans.org. The book is Bad Teacher: How Blaming Teachers Distorts the Bigger Picture. Kevin Kumashiro, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me and for covering this really important topic.
As with other of his maneuvers, the intent of Donald Trump's executive order on regulation might have been equally well conveyed by a crayoned sign, in this case reading, "Regulations bad." For any new rule added, agencies are directed to, unless prohibited by law, identify at least two existing regulations to be repealed. And the cost of all new regulations, quote, shall be no greater than zero, close quote. As with other of his orders, it's not clear that this can even be implemented without tangling various agencies in knots, and equally unclear how much that matters, since the intent can be plenty destructive on its own. Amit Narang is regulatory policy advocate at Public Citizens Congress Watch. The group has just filed suit against Trump based on this order. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Amit Narang.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, the order seems at a glance to rely on an almost cartoonish understanding of how regulation works or why it exists, for that matter. But with reference to Public Citizens' lawsuit around it, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer just said that that suit presumes a lot of outcomes that are wildly inaccurate. So I wonder how you respond to that claim and what the grounds are for Public Citizens' suit around this executive order.
I think that that claim by Mr. Spicer is laughable. Essentially, what he's saying is that, oh, no, you know, this executive order is not going to operate the way we intend it to operate, which is to make it almost impossible to regulate in areas that are key to protecting the public's health, safety, making sure Wall Street is accountable to the public and not acting recklessly, environmental protections. And let's be clear, President Trump has made claims that he wants to get rid of 75% of existing regulations without specifying, of course, which ones those are. But you can't do that without touching bedrock fundamental protections that the public takes for granted, frankly, and that Congress has produced legislation to protect that is some of the most popular legislation that Congress has ever produced, stuff like the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, or the Dodd-Frank Act. If that is the case, that Trump wants to essentially take an axe to the regulatory state, then it's ridiculous for Mr. Spicer to say that the way we are reading the executive order, which is that agencies will be simply unable to regulate in critical areas across the board, somehow that is a problematic reading of the EO. It's exactly what the EO intends, and we are taking it very seriously. I assume the administration is as well. I wonder where these remarks are coming from Mr. Spicer.
Well, as with many things Trump, one wants to both say, you know, what is this nuttiness, and then also to say, well, it doesn't come out of nowhere. You know, when Donald Trump talks about there being 72 rules for something, he's trading on an existing idea that there are lots of dusty, arcane regulations that businesses nevertheless have to comply with, which if they didn't, those businesses would be providing jobs and, you know, national prosperity. This is kind of taking it to the nth degree, but bigger picture, how do we argue back against that general idea?
Well, so the general idea, as you're saying, is false, that regulation somehow costs the economy. In fact, if anything is true, it's the opposite. We saw that with the Wall Street crash. Massive deregulation of Wall Street led to $14 to $22 trillion in lost wealth to this country. That was average Americans mostly bearing those losses and losing their homes. Okay, to be clear, regulation protects jobs, protects our economy. Now, of course, big businesses and corporate America and conservatives that are ideologically opposed to regulation want to paint this picture, which is a completely false picture. With respect to the presumption underlying this executive order that there are tons of old regulations that serve no purpose, that are all dusty and laying around and can be easily repealed, and of course, since they serve no purpose, they must be costing corporate America a lot of money. That's a little bit of sarcasm. I don't know how they reconcile that. But even that presumption is false. Why? Because President Obama initiated in 2011 what's called regulatory retrospective review process, where he asked agencies to look at the rules that they had on their books and see if, in fact, there were any of these old regulations that really weren't serving any purpose that would be able to be repealed without harming the public. And they did find some. They didn't find that many, and frankly, they didn't come anywhere close to pleasing corporate America with this initiative. But in any case, they did find some, and they did repeal them. And this is a real problem for the Trump administration's implementation of this executive order. Because under the executive order, in order for agencies to put out new regulations, let's say updated lead standards in drinking water, which is not a hypothetical, the EPA is supposed to do that in 2017. In order for the EPA to do that, they have to find a regulation that doesn't serve any purpose, that's just sitting on the books, that's costing the energy industry money to get rid of. Well, if those regulations have already been identified by the Obama administration, have already been repealed, what are they going to turn to? Then we start talking about regulations that absolutely still serve a purpose, that still protect the public. Say, getting mercury out of the water, essentially by requiring power plants to not spew mercury out when they spew out emissions that eventually fall into the water that then make its way into the food that we eat. Are we going to sacrifice a mercury regulation in order to then regulate lead in drinking water? You know, I'm constantly amused by claims from the Trump administration and other conservatives that they aren't against regulation. And yet, at every step, they're trying to stop any regulation that the EPA does to enforce the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, to combat climate change. And frankly, that happens across agencies when it comes to public health and safety.
Well, I just want to draw out one point, which I think doesn't get a lot of attention, which is that there's a substrain, isn't there, of this regulations versus jobs argument that says that people of color in particular should be resentful of red tape that's impeding their advancement somehow. I wonder how you address that idea in particular, that for some reason regulations are pose a particular harm for poor people and people of color.
So the theory, just to give it its due in terms of explaining it, is that because regulation imposes costs on consumer products, imposes costs on electricity prices, now that's them saying it, not me, but let's just take it as a plausible hypothetical. Because consumers bear those costs of regulations, it hits the poor, and thus I presume the assumption is minorities, harder than it hits wealthy Americans. Now, I don't believe that is the case. Public Citizen has shown in report after report that climate change regulations do not result in increased electricity prices in any state in this country. In fact, they will result in reduced energy prices because of the energy efficiency measures that are forced through regulatory action on climate change. But these are corporate lobby shop driven studies. And so, of course, they can show what they want to show. The truth is that, as I mentioned, a lack of regulation hits the poor and the vulnerable the hardest. This is just in terms of the pocketbook. The Obama administration successfully put out a regulation near the end of the term to increase overtime pay. That will absolutely help the poor in this country, poor workers in this country.
And women as well, yeah.
Environmental justice measures will help those urban areas where the dirtiest power production facilities are inevitably located. And then moving beyond that, regulation has been critical to combating discrimination. And that has been a direct benefit to minorities in this country. So this is absolutely a false narrative that really doesn't reflect the lived reality of the poor and minorities in this country.
I don't think I was the only one who was dismayed to see a New York Times story headlined, "Scott Pruitt is seen cutting the EPA with a scalpel, not a cleaver." I mean, you got the substance that Pruitt was expected to reduce the EPA's effectiveness, perhaps to near meaninglessness, but you still felt like you were somehow supposed to be pleased that he was a surgeon, not a butcher, who, quote, knows the legal intricacies of environmental regulation and deregulation, close quote. Now, I'm not saying every headline should be run for your life, but this seemed a little bit like misplaced emphasis. What kinds of reporting would be helpful? You can respond to that, of course, but also what kinds of reporting would be helpful in conveying the set of issues at stake here?
So I agree. That's disappointing that Scott Pruitt is being represented in that way. He is a potential EPA head that simply doesn't believe in a federal role for regulating the environment. This despite the fact that environmental issues, of course, cross state boundaries. Clean water is not something that is just related to one state. Dirty water passes state lines, just like with air pollution. And of course, climate change is the biggest threat. And that is not something that is a state-level threat. That's a federal threat. That's a global threat. I think what we need in terms of reporting is far more skepticism towards putting in place individuals that head these agencies that fundamentally disagree with the mission of those agencies. And then beyond that, to the extent that they are citing what's viewed as statistics or some kind of grounding and basis for their anti-regulatory or deregulatory measures, you know, those have to be vetted far more carefully. Industry and industry lobbyists in D.C. get away with so much when it comes to what they claim to be studies and reports that only look at the economic costs of regulation to their clients, to their industries, and never look at the benefits of regulations, the very real benefits, but the less tangible benefits when it comes to clean air, clean water, a safe financial system that doesn't implode, safe food, anti-discrimination measures. I think we're going to see now, just like with Obamacare and the attempt to repeal Obamacare, now all of a sudden people realize, oh, this is a very important law that gives us tangible benefits. The same thing is going to happen in the regulatory space, and I really think that journalists need to point out exactly what's at stake and exactly what people will be losing as the Trump administration seeks to repeal all sorts of Obama-era regulations and potentially even older regulations that absolutely benefit the public greatly.
We've been speaking with Amit Narang. He's regulatory policy advocate at Public Citizens Congress Watch. You can follow their work, including their lawsuit against Donald Trump, online at citizen.org. Amit Narang, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure. Anytime.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.